Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gib.
We're going to start off with emails, one of which, I think this is relatively unusual for us on this program, is an email in response to an email we read last time and from the same person.
Really?
Yeah, from Paula. I don't think you saw that. I don't know if you saw that one. You read Paula's email last week or the week before.
I remember this. She wrote in with a tip for people who are having problems falling asleep, and her tip was to go through the alphabet saying animal names to start off with. A, B, C, D. So let me find an animal with A. How about armadillo?
Aardvark.
Beaver. Cat. That kind of thing, all the way to Z. And then I said I tried the tip, Paula, and I got stuck on I. And in the meantime, iguana. Of course, I should have gone with iguana. Yeah.
Anyway, but Paula, then she says, Paula has written in since.
Yeah. Ebek, N, narwhal, or newt. X, Zerus, are also difficult. But since I'm trying to relax, I don't stress if I miss a letter. Rodents wasn't a joke. You said that...
She was serious.
No, she says rodents wasn't a joke. It's a way that I just slow down and think of all the critters that I can. Glad you tried it. You bet, Paula.
Yeah, so thank you for sending that in.
Mm-hmm.
We have another email on that same subject from Emily in Seattle saying she's always proud to hear her homeboy, Connor. And she's saying that because I'm from Seattle. From the greater Seattle area originally. She sent a list of all the animals, A to Z, with animal names, and then some of the random things like xanthan gum.
Xanthan gum.
Okay, I was saying that wrong.
I was making jokes about that.
Yeah.
As being an emulsifier.
Yeah, she's talking about how it's created in this email and finishes off by saying that when she has trouble falling asleep, she puts on a podcast series just above the level where she can't make out the words anymore. So it's kind of this murmuring in the background, and that she uses our podcast in a similar manner, but only after first actually listening to it and gleaning the information from it.
Yeah.
Great to hear that, Emily. Another email kind of from the region. Gabe, I don't think you get these anymore, from a longtime listener who writes us quite a lot. His name's Mark.
His messages always land in my spam, and I just don't have time to check it.
You don't check your spam box?
No.
At spam box, that's a wild thing to look into.
I don't want to go in there.
It is kind of ugly in there.
But now that it's Mark, right?
It's Mark. So it took me a second to understand this. He wrote about the raccoon research.
Oh, there were a lot of people writing in about that.
Yeah. Wow. It's too bad we can't read all those, but Mark wrote in with a photo that I first thought, oh, it was just like a symbolic image or a standard image of a raccoon. Mm-hmm. And the longer I looked at it, I don't think it's that. I'm going to pass. You haven't seen this image, Gabe. I think our longtime listener, Mark, who lives in a tiny cabin in the rainforest, recreated something that we talked about on the show and took a picture of it. I'll let you describe that image.
I'm looking at a gigantic submarine sandwich here. This is a foot long, possibly.
At least.
It's a gigantic sub. And he's holding it to a raccoon who is at the front door, it looks like.
Almost going over
About to walk into the door. And Mark, are you trying to feed this raccoon the sub?
Yeah.
Because we joked last week.
Yeah. Last week.
With Rafaela?
We talked to Rafaela.
Yeah.
About her research on raccoons. And one of the anecdotes she mentioned, one of our favorite parts of the whole interview, was not scientific at all. She had thrown an empty Red Bull can into a trash can on a university campus.
And then it went boink.
Yeah, it made a strange sound. It turned out there was a raccoon in there devouring a foot-long roast beef sandwich. And we thought that was wonderful and left that in the interview. All of you heard it. And Mark, a longtime listener, recreated it.
Yes.
There's no way he found that picture on the internet of some, I don't think, that looks like his tiny cabin. We've seen pictures of it before.
Yeah.
One of the better emails we've received in a while. Mark, happy to hear what happened with that sandwich and with that raccoon. Gabe, you've got...
I'm gonna get into my spam if you tell us what's going on there.
Yeah.
Science? Should we jump into it?
Yeah, we should jump into it. I'm going to start with something. I'll admit that my interest in this new study was kind of personal. There's a very small supermarket. For some of our listeners out there, it'll make sense when I say it's smaller than a Trader Joe's.
Mm-hmm.
That here in Germany, you have very, very small supermarkets sometimes, and they're super convenient because you can put them anywhere. This is where I go a lot of times. This is where my kids go a lot of times, and a lot of kids go because it's close to a school.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys at the checkout has something wrong, a skin disease.
Yeah.
And it's very apparent, all up and down his arms and hands. And the only reason I bring it up, I've seen it, but my kids asked, and I think the other kids probably make mean jokes or they're scared of it, right? You see a disease that you don't understand, you're fearful of it, and you want to stay away. And they'd asked me before, hey, what's wrong with him? I don't know. And I didn't know, honestly, because I hadn't come into such close personal contact before with eczema. I can only assume that it's a one-to-one match based on the imagery I've looked at on the internet, also called atopic dermatitis. This is a skin condition. A lot of our listeners already know what it looks like. Rashy, dry skin, painfully cracked, red, irritated, triggered by allergens or irritants. There's no known cure. That's why you see it. And all you're doing is managing symptoms if you have this. It's not contagious. That's very important information, at least for the local kids around me. Also, interesting to know, it affects black people more than white people in prevalence, severity, and persistence. And in the U.S., black children are diagnosed with eczema at about 2 times the rate. It affects different groups very differently. Lots of people around the world have this, something like 6 to 10% of U.S. adults, higher in Asia, Africa. And again, it's triggered by something. Allergens. Some of them are kind of known. Pollen, dust mites, weather, like when it's dry, the winter is a bad time, stress. But here comes the study out of the U.K., published in the British Journal of Dermatology. They asked people with eczema, what would you want us to study to help you?
Oh, wow.
About
the disease in particular?
Yes. Yeah. What questions do you have that you want to have answered and that science hasn't answered yet?
Yeah.
And the answer they got was bathing. So detergents or soaps can be an irritant sometimes, but it's kind of for everyone. Or
which ones cause it, or which ones lead to it? Or?
Yeah. And is it due to bathing? The act of getting very, very, very wet in the shower?
Mm-hmm.
And then what is it? Let's at least try to exclude one of those things. So they tipped 400 people. Who have children and adults who have eczema, randomly assigned them to two different groups, totally random, forced the one group, kind of intervened, said, hey, you're going to shower at least 6 times a week or bathe.
Mm-hmm.
The other group, just 1 to 2 times.
Yeah.
And what they established is there is no difference.
Regardless of how many times you bathe, not going to have an effect on eczema.
Exactly. I'm just going to quote the lead researcher. She said, the findings of our study are great news for people living with eczema. It means they can choose a frequency of bathing that suits them. It was fantastic to work so closely with people living with eczema to co-design the study. Together, we're starting to answer questions about living with eczema that haven't had enough attention in research until now. I just thought that was, I loved from start to finish how they did that one. And if anyone out there would like to research more or look into this more, the title of the study is Weekly versus Daily Bathing for People with Eczema, Results of the Eczema Bathing Online Randomized Controlled Trial.
DW. Made for Minds.
This next study here is what knowing whether the people around you are rich, how much money they have, the effect that will have on whether you would support taxation or redistribution of wealth.
Real quick, I thought you were going to talk about envy. We've talked about that before. Feelings of envy.
Now, this kind of study makes you think about those things, but we'll get to that in a bit. 1,400 participants based in the U.S. They were assigned to two groups. You were either rich or poor, and you were put in a group of 24 people, but you could only see how rich 8 of those 24 were. So you're either rich or poor, and you can see how much money 7 other people around you have.
Yeah.
And then they wanted to see how, based on that social network, what effect that will have on whether you would want higher or lower taxes for the whole group.
Interesting.
Whole group.
So in some of these scenarios, because if I'm doing the math right, if you've got 1,400 people, 24 groups, or 24 in each
many
group.
Many different iterations of the same experiment. They just wanted to see based on
50.
how rich or how poor the people are, because they varied that each time.
More than 50 different sets of the same experiment.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's looking at how, based on the relative wealth of the people around you, what that effect will have on whether you want higher taxation.
Right. Because in some groups, I'm just as rich or poor as everyone, and sometimes it's wildly different than me.
Right. The more visible that inequality is, what effect will that have on on how you feel about taxation.
Yeah.
If you are in a group where everyone else, so you're poor, everyone else is poor, you want lower taxation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a group where you are rich and everyone else that you can see, those seven other people, are also rich, you want lower taxation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a group where you are poor and everyone else is rich, you want high taxation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are in a group where you are rich and everyone else is poor, you still want higher taxation,
oh.
But not as high as if you were poor and everyone else is rich.
Right. So that last conclusion
yeah.
goes against the idea that, you know, once you get rich,
exactly.
you turn your back on everyone else right. and think, I just want to keep mine.
Yeah.
That shows that no, they still look backwards and say, hey, this is unfair.
Yeah, the conclusion that the researchers at the London School of Economics drew from that was that the more visible inequality is, the more that could lead to willingness to redistribute wealth more. But what the second part of the experiment was also interesting. They were looking at how satisfied you were with the whole situation based on which group you were in. The more inequality you saw, especially if you were poor, the more dissatisfied you were. It made you angry, and it also tended to make you feel like there was more polarity, less unity between the groups. So it leads to a willingness to redistribute wealth, but it also has that catch that you are going to feel less good about your situation.
Of course. That's, yeah. Confirming what I think a lot of us have felt before, or a lot of people around the world have felt. Very quickly at the end here, paid attention to one study because it contradicted what we had talked about before on the show,
oh.
which is that music improves well-being if you keep playing music in old age. This particular study out of Australia straight up says the opposite. It says cognitive well-being does not go up as a result of playing music.
Playing music, okay.
Right, and what may be different is that when we talked about that in the past, the study we talked about had groups learning music together.
Yeah.
That may explain the difference away.
You had to learn with the group, together
right.
with the group.
So yeah. maybe
down in Australia.
Yeah. For those who've listened to us for a long time, the study that we talked about months ago, which caused us to play some Beethoven music and then air it on the show,
yeah.
that study had people playing music in groups, and hence the well-being effect might have been as a result of that. But this study, 10,000 people over the age of 70 in Australia, two different longitudinal studies, and what they found is that they're looking at dementia, and if you listen to music consistently every single day, a 39% reduced risk
of dementia.
Of developing dementia.
Oh, wow.
Playing music, a 35% drop. I thought that was a surprise that it wasn't the other way around.
Yeah.
Listening seems to be more of an indicator than playing. Yeah. In any case.
Even though playing is way more active than just passive listening.
This is just an association, because that was my first thought. No way. It could be that the people who have healthy brains are listening to music and hence they're not, right?
Okay.
And as soon as you start developing dementia, you don't listen to music. What this fundamentally concludes really is that if you have an elderly loved one, that playing music of any kind on the radio or trying to play might be a barometer of their cognitive health.
Yeah.
That's if they're still doing it, they're in good cognitive health.
And if it's not on, would the tip be to put it on? Why not?
You could if there is a causal mechanism, and that's what they're really trying to get at, because right now around the world, 65 million plus cases of dementia. Fast forward to 2050, we're at 150 million. It would be great to reduce that somehow, even if it means just delaying it by a couple of years.
Anything you guys have to say about anything we've said today, su@dw.com. I hope I said that clearly enough. And maybe here's a bit of music. Do you ever feel overwhelmed? Not necessarily by anything specific. Like even when you can't pinpoint it or know exactly what is leading to that feeling of being just overwhelmed? Maybe it's society?
even more specifically.
Or humanity,
yeah.
or the world's spinning too fast.
A lot of things have changed since we dropped out of trees 6-something million years ago. A lot of things have changed, and especially in the last couple hundred years. And if that's making you feel out of place or not very good, there's research to suggest you're absolutely right.
Science Unscripted.
Okay. I'm Danny Longman. I'm a senior lecturer in anthropology at Loughborough University in the UK. And together with Dr. Colin Shaw of Zurich University, we've just published a paper on the effect of industrialization on human biology.
Danny, this is usually when I would ask what the conclusion of your paper is, but I believe it may be more appropriate here to ask you, what is the hypothesis of your research?
Yes, so we have proposed a new hypothesis known as the environmental mismatch hypothesis, which essentially contends that our nature-adapted biology might be poorly aligned with our contemporary urban lifestyles and our urban homes today.
And in plain language, what exactly are you saying with that hypothesis? What to our listeners around the world who don't know that jargon specifically, what are you saying?
Yeah, so essentially what we're saying here is that for the vast majority of our history as a species, we've been spent this in natural environments. It was nature's savannas, forests, and coastlines that shaped our biology. But since the Industrial Revolution, we have very rapidly and profoundly changed our environment. And we contend that the rate of change of our environment is exceeding our ability to adapt. So now we have a mismatch between our nature-adapted biology and the urban environments that we live in.
You're using very cautiously neutral language. There's a mismatch. It has exceeded our capacity. But I believe, right, what you're really saying is the world around us has changed in a way that we haven't evolved to necessarily like or be happy with.
That's exactly what we're saying. Our environment is changing so quickly. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've moved en masse from rural areas into cities, and these cities are posing significant environmental challenges to us that we're not adapted to. For example, air pollution, microplastic accumulation, overcrowding, all of these sensory bombardments are things that we've never had to encounter in our evolutionary past. And alongside that, we're losing contact with natural aspects of our historical environments that we need for optimal function and health. So combined, these new stresses, the lack of contact with nature, we're seeing some quite compelling evidence that this is harmful to our biology today.
And how are you what are you basing these conclusions on? Where did you get the data to conclude that there's a mismatch between how fast the world is moving and what we're prepared for?
That is a great question. So we've combined our own experimental evidence with that of other groups around the world. We've taken evidence from the fields of anthropology, ecology, physiology, and public health. And what we're seeing is a significant effect, really significant evidence of an effect of industrialized environments on our biology. So, for example, we see very high rates of chronic stress, both physiological and mental, in city environments. But we're also starting to see impaired reproductive function, impaired cognition, impaired immunity, and physical function suffering in urban environments as well, in relation to natural environments.
Is it possible to say that the urban environment is causally creating those issues in human beings? I would assume this is association at this point, correct? Or can we put people, can we force them into an urban environment for a couple of days and then study the results?
That is a great question. So initially, there was a lot of observational data, as you say, correlational data that cannot necessarily infer causation. But our group, as well as another few groups around the world, have been doing experimental work where we now can see causal effects of industrialized environments in damaging our biology.
And what would those causal effects be? What are they looking at specifically?
So the majority of work in this area has looked at stress. So spending time, if you experimentally put someone in a city environment compared to, say, a forest, we see much higher levels of stress. So we see higher blood pressure, higher heart rate, higher cortisol hormone levels. But we're also starting to see functional impairment now. So we see immune function dysregulation, we see cognitive impairment. So people's creativity, people's problem-solving ability actually suffers in urban environments. And linked to that, we see markers of reproductive function suffer. And most recently at Loughborough, we've observed physical impairment, so reduced endurance performance, for example, after visiting a city compared to a forest.
And what is it exactly about being in that city that has those deleterious effects on us?
So that is the question right now. What we're trying to do as the next phase of our research is work out the mechanisms. You know, what is it specifically in the environment that is causing these effects? Now, there is some data at the moment suggesting that air pollution has a big effect, inducing stress, impairing various functions. Microplastic accumulation has a huge effect. Noise pollution, air pollution at night, light pollution, which will impair sleeping and disrupt circadian rhythm. All of these things combine, we think, to give this negative effect.
When you're talking about industrialization or the way the world has changed around us compared to, you know, how we all lived very rural lives hundreds, thousands of years ago, are you also including technology?
Yes, absolutely. So what we've seen since the 1950s with the Great Acceleration, but more recently with the social media revolution, is that technology is having a huge effect. On top of all of the environmental shifts, we now have constant digital connectivity, 24/7 information flow, and more recently AI-mediated interactions. And essentially our stress response systems have evolved for short bursts of acute threat, but not for continuous notifications and the absence of genuine psychological off time. So in that sense, we do think that the digital environment is amplifying this mismatch created initially by industrialization.
I saw a poll before coming down here that said 8 out of 10 people globally, was done by GlobeScan. They looked around the world at everyone. It seems 8 out of 10 people think the world is moving too fast. So this is nothing new. It's a pervasive opinion around the world, yet I don't think anything is going to be done about it. Or at the moment, nothing is being done to counteract how fast the world is moving or society is developing. Do you have any ideas? I know it's not your field of research particularly, but how we could slow down?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole purpose of the research we're doing is to be able to ultimately apply our insight to contribute towards solving global problems such as this that you mentioned. I think essentially what we need to do is start to design cities, design the urban environments that we live in with human biology in mind. So this might include when we're expanding cities, including green corridors, including parks, readily made access to nature with initiatives to reduce pollution. But in terms of how fast things are moving, we start to see a few countries now, for example, Australia, imposing bans on social media for children. And I think initiatives like this certainly need discussing going forward as we integrate human well-being into the design of our lives in the 21st century.
Gabe and I happen to live close to and work in Bonn, Germany, which has to be up there in terms of a city that is designed pretty well to make human beings happy. I mean, I bike in here all the time, right next to the Rhine River. It's pretty nice. But a lot of our listeners out there are going to hear what you're saying and say, "Well, I can't, Danny. I can't change my city, man. What are you talking about?" So I guess for them, what can they do to escape this superstructure of human unhappiness that has been built around them and before they were even born?
So what the research is showing is that even very brief exposures to nature can have a significant and meaningful effect on human biology. For example, spending only 15 minutes in a forest reduces stress levels, it reduces cortisol, decreases blood pressure, decreases heart rate, and improves mental well-being. So what I'd suggest is, of course, we can't change the city on an individual level. We can't change the cities that we're living in. But what we can do is to try to increase our contact with the natural world. So if you can, go for a walk near a river, go to a forest, or even try to bring natural aspects into your home. A recent piece of work that we published in Nature Scientific Reports showed that simply listening to nature-based sounds, whether it's bird song, running water, wind rustling through tree leaves can have a significant effect on human biology.
And Danny, what do you do when you need a break from Loughborough? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are indeed Loughborough. That's right.
But seriously, what do you do? Do you get into nature as much as possible because you know what effect that might have?
And also with your phone. Wait, what do you bring it? Do you leave it home? Do you lock it up? What's your life like, Danny?
Yeah, so I spend as much time being physically outdoors as possible. Running, cycling, walking, swimming in nature in the mountains and the forest. Combining that physical activity with the natural environments is what does it for me. As much time as possible moving outdoors. And with regards to my phone, quite often I do take it because I like to take photos. I might sometimes need it for navigation, maps, etc. But essentially moving in nature has a lot of value to it, I think.
So Danny, if I've understood you correctly, if Gabe and I, instead of playing music, which is what we usually do at the end of an interview with an expert like you, if instead of doing that, we play nature sounds, we're going to reduce the stress and help the lives, possibly, of our listeners. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. We see decreased physiological stress, improved mental well-being, even improvements in things like productivity, cognition, problem-solving, creativity. A bit of nature in your life, even if it is just sound, can go a long way.
And that was Danny Longman, who's part of the School of Sport, Exercise, and Health Sciences at Loughborough University in England. And if you're interested in reading more into what he has to say, it's 17 pages, very readable, open access, and the title is Homo Sapiens, Industrialization, and the Environmental Mismatch Hypothesis, published in Biological Reviews.
Yeah, and that study that I quoted, where 8 of 10... The people listening to this right now, you probably, based on that, agree with us. And if you're like me, I look at it pessimistically. As I look to the future, I don't see the world slowing down at any point. So this is one where you have to do something about it individually.
Yes. I still kind of agree with you, even though I'm more optimistic. To take one example, pollution in major cities as a result of electric cars is dropping. That's one thing that is improving. Light pollution. Nobody was talking about that a couple decades ago. Now LED lamps have changed the equation quite dramatically. It is improving, where I totally agree with you is I'm not in control of that.
No.
I can't control that.
No.
What I can do is look at my calendar or wherever I go to think about what are my future plans and then try to put something outdoorsy in there. I know it's a tough time of the year in the Northern Hemisphere to go for that walk. You need boots for the mud.
Yeah, but even if you can't physically get there with your boots on, you can turn on sounds. We've looked at research over the past few years about what listening to sounds, whether they're created digitally or not, can do to your well-being. If you put birdsong on from time to time or put natural sounds on, which I think we're going to do here at the
end. I was just going to say,
the show.
You don't have to do that. We're going to do it for you right now. If you have anything to say on this topic or any way that you drop your stress, let us know, su@dw.com, but just relax and enjoy.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.